Hello and welcome to an on-time edition of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network, coming to you every Tuesday from 12 to 12:45. I'm Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, here again with Nastasha the Hammer Lopez, back from her Florida trip. Calling all of your questions, cooking-related or otherwise, to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Today's show is brought to you by Hearst Ranch. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, which is a long time, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, go to www.hearstranch.com. That's www.hearstranch.com. They actually supplied the ribeye for the Heritage Radio fundraiser that was a couple months back, the one where we did the banana sustino drink. Yeah. Delicious. Right?
Delicious.
Good product. Anyway, so yesterday was Valentine's Day, and
what did you do for your wife, Dave?
Well, I bought flowers because I'm lazy. But the that's not the point. The point is that I was reminded by my third grade son the horrors that used to be Valentine's Day. I was that kid who, you know, when everyone was buying carnations for everyone, you know, they would buy carnations for their friend for like a dollar. Like, I was the one that got the mystery admirer carnation. Like, they didn't think I understood that that meant that no one bought me a damn carnation. And that so they just give one to you because no one's purchased one for you. You know what I mean? You know that kid? That kid was me, right? I mean, it's like Valentine's.
We didn't have that sympathy
Oh,
stuff.
Geez. Oh, really? Well, it's California.
I just didn't get one.
See, everyone thinks New York people aren't sympathetic. But in fact, you know, like, they give out the sympathy carnation. We're actually good people over here in New York, for those of you that don't know us. Anywho, so, you know, Valentine's Day was, you know, basically a yearly living nightmare horror story for me. Actually, up until, 1992, right, when I was 20, was the first year I had a good Valentine's, and it was the day I started dating a actual, you know, crackerjack, smart, badass, verifiable hot chick, whom I eventually married, and who's currently my wife. So, anyway, so Valentine's Day ended up being good for me, but was horrible for the first 20 years. And my son had this happen. He was, gave a Valentine to a girl in the third grade, and which he would never do. He's not that kind of a kid. He gives it to her and completely rebuffed.
No.
Like, yeah, Valentine on the floor.
No.
I don't want this. Complete horror. I felt awful. And my younger son, his brother, basically, who's an equal mix of really sensitive, sweet kid and gun-loving, crazy, rough-and-tumble boy monster, goes, all right, we're either going to kick her in the face or dip her in poop. And then, no one's saying anything because they don't know what to say because it's this crazy thing to say. And then after a couple of seconds, he's like, so which is it? Kick in the face or dip in poop? Anyway, that was Valentine's Day.
So, fucker.
Hey, no name. Anyway, I wasn't calling him out too bad. I guess everyone knows my son. Anyway, so another thing we're announcing, we just sent out the press release for the Museum of Food and Drink fundraiser. And the Museum of Food, do we have a call in?
Yeah.
All right, so I'll take the call first so I can spend the adequate amount of time on the Museum of Food and Drink. Hello, caller. You are on the air.
Hi. I've been working a lot lately with preserved lemons and Indian lime pickles and yuzu kosho. And I'd realized recently that I didn't actually understand kind of the mechanism of what's going on with salt curing citrus like that. It's the acidity and the salinity are too high for any sort of microbial or bacterial mechanism. So it's just got to be sort of the salt, the sort of controlled rot. But I don't really know what's going on. The whole thing gets darker and, you know, it gets thicker and the texture changes. I wonder if you could explain a little bit about what's going on there.
Wow, that's actually an excellent question. I haven't really thought about it. I'm sure that there's got to be some sort of bacterial growth, right? Otherwise, it would be purely an enzymatic reaction that's causing it to happen, which I don't think it is, because the thing definitely changes over time, right? So if it changes over time, either you're dealing with an enzymatic process, or you're dealing with a bacterial/enzymatic process, or it's probably not a yeast-based or any sort of fungal-based thing. I know that, you know who's an expert in this is Harold McGee. I'm gonna speak to him relatively soon. I should ask him. You've caught me completely off guard on something that I haven't studied. I do know that certain things do happen in them that look like they're bacteria based. For instance, you can get situations when you're curing them with certain kinds of lemons where you get like ropey substance forming in the cured lemon thing, which is probably some sort of polysaccharide, which I would guess is formed by bacteria, but could be just some sort of wonky thing happening to the pectin over time. I don't know. I wish I did. I'm sorry that. Do you have a question I might have an answer to? This is like the first time that I've been completely 100% stumped on what the correct answer is, right? Right, Nastasi? Nastasi's right. Dinner. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't think of it. I think I've listened to all the episodes, and I've never heard you miss one before.
I should give you some sort of prize for a complete stump out. But what I can do is I'll go online and I'll go into like the actual literature search, not just like the regular internets. So I'll go into Columbia's database of science literature, and I'll see if I can't find the stuff. And barring that, I will ask McGee, and he will tell me what's going on. And we did have a question where I did follow up next week, so Nastasha is now being very good about making sure I follow up. So listen in next week for the answer to the question, all right?
All right, and I'll post something to the forum to remind you.
Cool, thanks a lot.
Okay, bye.
Oh, depressing first call. Stumped.
Stumped.
Yep, that's me, big jerk. Anyway, so...
Museum.
So the Museum of Food and Drink is, you know, a museum that tried to start a long time ago, like six years ago, I guess. And, you know, Patrick Martins and I are now trying to get back off the ground again. And we're having a major fundraiser. And the fundraiser is going to be on Sunday, March 27th. And it's going to, you know, it's not cheap. It's, what is it?
It's cheap. For the food.
Well,
and
for what you get,
here,
it's cheap.
Yes. $250.
It's not inexpensive, but it's a bargain.
It's
anyway.
A 5-hour extravaganza.
Well, we don't know. We up to 5 hours extravaganza. Anyway, so we're putting it on, and here's the current. And what we're doing is we're getting a bunch of chefs and bartenders to come in to Del Posto, which is a fabulous, you know, restaurant in New York, 4 stars. Our friend Mark Ladner is the chef there. And we're getting a bunch of chefs and bartenders to come in and cook things based on specific themes, right? So we're giving them a theme, and their dish is going to be inspired by it. So here is the list in no particular order. Dave Chang, his theme is American food circa 1491. So that's going to be all foods that don't have, all foods from the Americas prior to the Columbian Exchange. That should be interesting. I'm thinking he's probably going to do something with acorns, which was a big Native American food stuff, but also a big Korean food stuff. So he could probably pull in like, you know, different levels of work there. So I'm assuming he's going to do something with acorns, but who knows? Wiley Dufresne, from WD 50, my brother-in-law. I gave him, because he's a well-known tech guy, I gave him caveman food. he was kind of mad at me, but you know, what are you gonna do? Caveman food. Paleolithic. Mark Ladner, the host chef from Del Posto, I gave him ancient Rome. Wiley actually texted me and was like, hey, you gave Mark a softball there with the ancient Rome, but not really. Ancient Roman cuisine is extraordinarily different from modern Italian cuisine, has a completely different basis, spice and ingredient basis, you know, based more on lovage seed and fish sauce and just a whole different ingredient base than what's known. So it's not really a softball. That's what he's going to be doing. Nils Norin, kind of the French culinary one, right? I gave him, just to be a jerk, I gave him fad diets. See what he does with that, fad diets. Cesare Casella, who's coming at the beginning, going to give us a whole bunch of delicious salumi to fit in with the fact that we knew he was going to bring salumi. We gave him shriveled meat as his category. Carlo from Roberta's, whose last name I've never been able to pronounce, so I'm going to try
it.
Mirarchi, but you got to say it like Mirarchi. Anyway, I don't know how you're supposed to pronounce it. Anyway, he's going to do New York food circa the early 1900s, or that was late 1800s, early 1900s?
1900s.
Early 1900s? Yeah. Okay. Brooks Headley, the pastry chef from Del Posto, is going to be doing Hebrew food in Italy, because there's a big group of people that basically had to leave Spain during the Inquisitions, settled in Italy, and brought some very interesting dessert things with them, some of which are kind of big in my family. And Christina Tozzi, also of Momofuku Milk Bar, or from Momofuku, but a milk bar, we're giving her, this is a tough one, space food. Here's why we're giving her space food. She was like, space food? Why are you giving me space food? I was like, well, Christina Tozzi, other than being being, you know, the fantabulous Christina Tozzi that she is, little known fact, she writes a lot of the HACCP plans for the sous vide programs here in the city that chefs have. And HACCP was originally developed by large food corporations like Pillsbury and for the space program, the idea being that they needed a zero-tolerance food system because if an astronaut gets the poops in the space, it's a big problem. So anyway, so as HACCP was developed in part for the space program, and is now used in basically in all industries for food. And so I gave her that as a tip of the hat to her HACCP skills. Audrey Saunders from the Pegu Club will be making drinks. Thomas Waugh from Death & Co. Also. Simon Ford, the head bartender for Pernod Ricard. Damian Bolte from Prime Meats. And Evan Clem from Be Our Guest Restaurants and fellow techie-related bartend dude will be doing it. All proceeds will go to the Museum of Food and Drink. Please go to http://mofad.com. That's MOFAD, like Museum of Food and Drink, .eventbrite. Spell it improperly, BRITE.com. That's http://mofad.eventbrite.com for more info. All right. That was a long plug.
Yeah.
Anyway, because we want you to come. It's going to be a great, great time. All right. Now, on to real questions. I have a question about tempering chocolate in the microwave. Most of the instructions I've seen are very complicated, requiring a good candy thermometer, and often instructions to use a microwave multiple times or add additional cold chocolate to the microwave chocolate, stirring, etc., etc. I've tried about 3 or 4 times simply putting 2 cups of chocolate chips into the microwave until they turn glossy and removing them, stirring them until they melt. Each time, this 2-step process has worked just fine. Are the additional steps and temperature precision really necessary? Have I just been getting lucky, or is something else at work? Kurt Kastorf. Well, I think you're just lucky, Kurt. Anyway, the point is that if that recipe works for you, like you will be repeatably lucky. If you do the same thing and it's working, then it should be able to repeat itself. Because here's what's actually going on and why the recipes are so complicated. And by the way, you have to make sure that the chocolate is actually tempering, right? Like, so you have to make sure it's actually getting a good temper. I mean, obviously anyone can just melt chocolate in the microwave. The question is, are you getting a good temper? If you are getting a good temper, and by the way, for those of you, well, you'll hear. Anyway, so chocolate has basically, the cocoa butter in it has roughly 6 ways of crystallizing, right? The cocoa butter can form 6 different crystal structures, and those crystal structures have different properties, right? So, and those crystals have different melting points, right? So what happens is, badly tempered chocolate is mostly in form 4, which is also known as beta prime. And good tempered chocolate is in form 5, which is beta crystals, right? So what happens is, if you heat chocolate up, melt out all the crystals, and then cool it down too rapidly, which is basically any kind of cooling that you're going to do to it is too rapid, it will form mostly type 4 beta prime crystals. And what those are is they're soft, right? Because they have a lower melting point, so they're very soft. They have a lot of they're not hard. They don't have a snap, and they're dull looking. They're not glossy. All in all, they're kind of crappy. And even if you didn't care about all the fact that it didn't have good texture and it melted too low, if you store those for a long time, they will convert from beta prime to beta. And that sounds like it's a good thing, right, Nastasha? Because the beta is what you want?
Yes.
Yeah, but it's a bad thing. You know why?
No.
Well, it's because all of the forms of as they get more and more hard and more stable, when they go from beta prime to beta, they contract. And when they contract from beta prime to beta, they squeeze fat out of the cocoa part, and you get that white fat bloom on the top. So poorly tempered chocolate will get fat bloom very quickly, even if you didn't care about the snap and all the rest of that stuff, right? Okay. So and so that's why the typical old school hardcore tempering technique is you melt out all of the crystals by taking it up to, you know, like a 115 or so Fahrenheit. Sorry, Celsius heads, we're going to do this one in Fahrenheit. And then you rapidly cool it down to, you know, in the 80s somewhere, and then crystals start forming, and then you reheat it up to about 94 or so to melt out all the crappy beta prime crystals. Right now all you have in there is beta crystals. Now when you cool it again, she'll be tempered, because those beta crystals will act like little seeds that everything kind of hooks onto, right? It's all about seeding it, right? The easy way, and that's if you're starting from all you have, you're on a desert island, you have a pot, a thermometer, and a bunch of untempered chocolate, right? That's how you would do it. Most of the time, what we do is we just melt the chocolate, right? We take it up melt it, bring it down into the range where beta crystals want to form in the 90s, right? And then stir in chopped up tempered chocolate that already have the good seeds in the good crystal form. And then all of a sudden, all of the chocolate as it cools will form those nice stable beta crystals, right? And, but you need at least about 1 to 3% of beta crystals mixed all throughout it. So you're stirring it, right, to cause it to happen, to seed it properly. Now, when you're doing it in the nuke, right, you're starting with hopefully with tempered chocolate. If you start with tempered chocolate, right, and you nuke it, so it's like you say, just glossy on the outside, and then you stir it, so long as the temperature of that thing is in the beta zone, right, in the like 90s, and not a low temperature where you're going to be forming bad beta prime crystals, right? So as soon as that last piece of chocolate melts, you're still in that like, you know, 92, 93, 94 Fahrenheit range in there, 95 in that zone, right? Then you will seed properly with beta crystals and it'll work. But the reason they have it like taking it out all the time and stirring it and then sometimes throwing in seed chocolate is because they're assuming that you're going to overheat the mass of chocolate so that when it's all melted, it's not going to be in the right temperature range. So yes, you got lucky, but maybe you'll get repeatably lucky. If I were you, I would save some seed chocolate to stir in after it's all melted just in case, and you can take the temperature when it's done and that should give you the answer. So long-winded, but I mean, chocolate tempering is an interesting subject. The good reference book to get on chocolate that's small is The Science of Chocolate by Stephen T. Beckett. It's expensive but small and fairly easy to read. I think probably a smaller investment and faster to read than the other book that people use now, Chocolate Science and Technology by Emmanuel Afoaqua, right? And I don't know that anyone uses the old chocolate reference. This is one I started using back in the day, which is Minifee. Minifee's big old chocolate book, right? And with that, we will go to our first commercial break. Call in all your questions to 718-497-2128. 718-497-2128. Cooking issues.
Let's take them up, Fred. We gotta take you higher. All right. You want to do it again?
Yeah, let's go on.
We gotta take you higher. All right.
All right.
I'm gonna get that fella with the little horn over there.
Right.
Get a chain horn on me.
Let's go.
Brad, can you take us higher?
Yeah.
Take us higher.
Welcome back to Cooking Issues. Call in your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. And although that's the longest we've played that song during the intermission, we still have not made it to Funky D. He's going to make it to Funky D in a little while, but we'd be here all day if we waited for James to go down to Funky D, although it is well worth the wait. I encourage you all to go out and do it to death, as James, I guess, actually did since he's now dead. Anyway, right? Dumb. Really dumb. I'm a dumb man. What do you want out of me? Okay. Jason writes in from England, And I think he was listening actually to 2 weeks ago, saying that he was listening to me answer the question about cookie texture using hydrocolloids. And he says more conventionally, you just use high gluten flour, and he won't get a bready cookie. He'll just limit the spread, which you know, I actually got confirmed and said last week from Christina Tozzi. But here's you know, further confirmation that what you want to do to get your cookie to not spread so much is use a high gluten flour. Jason adds a secondary thing, which is also let the cookie rest in the fridge for 24 hours. I guess that will, develop the cold will limit the spread, as we said, but also maybe developing some of the flour more. I don't know. But anyway, thank you, Jason, for that tip. Now, we had a question, and it sent me off on a bunch of research. So you're going to have to hear another one of my long-winded nonsense things. But Chris Anderson writes
before
it.
Before you get to your long-winded, you have a call.
Oh, we have a caller?
Mm-hmm.
All right, caller, you are on the air.
Hey, how are you doing, David?
Doing all right. See if we get a double stump this week. What do you got?
My name is Matt. I'm actually calling from Chicago.
Hey, Chicago. Hey, Matt from Chicago.
Actually, I used to work in New York with Wiley and Mark and all those guys. So
oh, nice.
I know all those guys.
You're not out there with Mike Sheeran, are you? Where are you cooking out in Chicago?
No. I'm actually a sous chef at a steakhouse, but they just opened. It's crazy busy, but it's a whole different story.
Yeah.
My question is, I'm really interested in the nitrous infusion using the ISI cream whipper.
Right.
And I was wondering if you've tried it with any viscous liquids like, say, honey or some kind of a scented syrup.
All right. I haven't, but okay, so here's the thing, right? Honey has, honey is just extremely thick, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if I was going to do it, I'm assuming it would work, but I think you'd want to keep the whole thing warmer than we normally keep it, right? So
gotcha.
I would put the whole ISI in, or EC. Which is it that they like
EC.
Now? EC, jeez. Anyway, I would put I'd do it. All it's not you, it's me. I can't, because in here it was one, and in Europe it was the other, and they're trying to make it both the same now, but like no one can keep it straight. And when I say no one, me, no one else seems to have a problem. Anyway, EC. So I would put the whole thing into a warm bain-marie for a while, and the reason is you just need it to be thin enough to get accurate, you know, to get punched into the pores of your product, right? So if you get it nice and liquidy by warming it, then I think it should work, you know. But you have to keep it liquid, like warm, during the whole process down to the time when you're venting it, so that it can also bubble back out again. I've never tested it, but I have high hopes that it will work. Let me put it that way.
Outstanding. Sounds cool.
But give it a shot, and then let us know how it works.
Oh, yeah, they will. And I got another thing on the Ouzo effect.
Right.
I was listening to the old shows on the way into work the other day, and I was like, I honestly didn't believe that you could cloudy the water. I used to drink pastises a lot, and I didn't think that the liquor would get cloudy just by dilution. And so I had to try it. And the interesting thing is that it does obviously get cloudy by dilution, but if you put it in the microwave for less than 10 seconds, the cloudiness goes away. And then by adding more ice cubes to it, the cloudiness comes back. So I tried it with boiling hot water. I tried it with tea water, and it still gets, the cloudiness still comes in from dilution, but it goes away much faster with heat.
Huh. So
it's an interesting thing.
Yeah, so... Huh, so when you're heating, that actually makes sense to me, right? So what's happening is you're adding water, and as you add water, you reach a point at any given temperature where the oil is no longer soluble in that percentage of ethanol, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it instantly forms little micro droplets of oil, and that's what makes it look cloudy. If you let it sit at that temperature for a long time, sometimes depending, I don't know with pastis, but with some of the stuff that I make, that cloudiness, the oil will actually float to the top, and then it won't be cloudy anymore, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what you're saying is you heat it, and when you heat it, you're re-increasing the solubility of the oil into the remaining ethanol fraction, right? Because presumably you're not boiling. If you boiled it, you'd probably make the problem worse. But by heating it, you're increasing the solubility of the product and causing it to go clear again. And then when you drop the temperature again by adding ice, you're doing two things. One, you're watering it down more, which is going to increase the dropout. And you're also decreasing the temperature, which increases the dropout. That makes sense, but that's interesting. But I've never experimented with it before.
Yeah. It was just a weird thing. I thought I had to try it out. So I'd let you know.
All right, cool. Thanks a lot.
Well, thanks, man, and I'll let you know how the honey goes, okay?
Very good. Thanks so much.
You have another call.
Sure. Take it easy.
Oh, we have another caller. Caller, you were on the air.
Hi, Dave. I was messing around with some Nepalese the other day, and I cut them into cubes, and I was just soaking them in some water, and I noticed this gelatinous substance was forming, and I guess that's the substance that the cacti use to, like, retain moisture in the desert, right?
Right. It's like, well, like hydrocolloids, similar to, like, what aloe vera has, right?
Okay, so is it like a mucilage like okra or like filet, or is that a completely different class?
That's interesting. I haven't researched whether or not it can be used as a thickener. It is sure is slimy. Interestingly enough, on Sunday, yeah, I was cooking nopales, and you know how, I mean, when I cook them, I always, you know, I try to get the I try to get the spines off with the minimum of damage, because
right,
I know they're going to ooze out a lot, you know? And so I usually grill them first and then let them cool down a bit before I slice them, so they don't get too slimy on me. But I've never tried to actively extract the slime. So did you decant the slime off that was in the water and then try to use it for something, or no?
I did not, but I probably will try it in the future. But the first thing I thought of was like okra and other, you know, other thickeners, and I wonder how it would compare.
I'm sure it's probably, look, I mean, all different hydrocolloids have different actions, and we're used to thinking of hydrocolloids as being these things that come in powdered form. But in reality, yeah, hydrocolloids are all, most are just like what you say. They come from natural sources, and they've been discovered in natural ways. Like most of the seaweed, like, you know, you can extract carrageenan from Irish moss by boiling it, right? Or you can, and so okra basically has this kind of snotty, slimy stuff that is actually a natural hydrocolloid, just not one that's used industrially, so it doesn't get lumped in. But, you know, many products have, you know, these things. So there's a chef from Spain, I forget who it was who did it, but, you know, made a lot of demos basically using the natural hydrocolloids in aloe vera, right? Although I guess if you do that wrong, it can give you the poops because of the latex. But to answer your question, I don't know of any commercially used cactus-based thickening things, but, you know, it is some polysaccharide, right? So it is some hydrocolloid. And then the question is, what are its properties? It doesn't seem like it's a gelling hydrocolloid, right? It seems more like a thickener, if you ask
exactly.
me. But the question is, like, will it thicken without making things too slimy? It's a fairly slimy stuff, you know what I mean? It's more on the order, like you say, of okra. And so when you over-thicken with okra as opposed to filet, like those things can take on a bit of a slippery nature, right? Which I actually kind of like for those dishes, but some people don't. You know what I mean? Like some people don't get down with the okra. I happen to think that okra is one of God's gifts to, you know, humanity. I love okra, but a lot of people do not. I don't know why. Fried okra is one of the great things in the world. Anyway, so I think, again, I have noticed this effect, but I haven't seen whether there's any. You know what I'll do? Again, I'm not going to count this as a complete stump, by the way, because I do know what you're talking about. But what I'll do is I'll try and see whether anyone has characterized what the polysaccharides are in the nopales. And by the way, for those of you who don't know what the hell we're talking about, I realize nopales are like prickly pear cactus leaves. You can buy them in Latin stores. Be careful, because some of them are relatively innocuous, but some of them, the spines can be pretty nasty and can get in your fingers when you're working with them. Scrape off the spines with a knife. I cut off usually the very tip end, which is the only part I cut off because it's hard to scrape that thing accurately. Brush with oil, salt, pepper, grill. Enjoy, because they're delicious. They're also kind of sour. They're slimy and kind of tart and kind of delicious. Don't you think so? I think so.
I agree.
Yeah. Anyway, so I'll try and see whether anyone has characterized what the polysaccharide is in there. And meanwhile, you see whether you can thicken up a stew with them and give us a holler back.
All right. Thanks, Dave.
All right. Very good. Thank you.
Let's take a break.
All right. We will take our – Nastasha's telling me we will take our second commercial break, even though that was a short segment because I took the long one too last. Anyway, 718 – what is it? 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Cooking Issues.
Ha ha ha! something I'm about to say. Yeah, Lord. You know what? When I hear a groove like this groove,
and things.
Look here. Somebody got a groove like this. You know. You know. No. I need the grit. Got the grit. Gonna eat. Got the grit. Get the job. Got the job. Need the grit. Got the grit in the bread. You know. I believe, hey, Brad Thomas, brother, I'm getting ready to wave y'all in. You know what? I feel so down. I need to get down. In order for me to get down, I got to get in deep. In order for me to get down, I got to get in deep. Need to get in deep. Dog the D.
Oh yeah, down D, that's the balls. Goes down to D. Everyone else goes up, James goes down. Back here, cooking issues, calling your questions too. 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. All right, Chris Anderson writes in. He says, I've tried making authentic French macaroons a few times, and while they taste great, I don't seem to be able to achieve the polished flat look of La Durée, which is, you know, the famous French macaroon shop in Paris. Mine tend to crack and collapse as they are baking. Would it help to use an Italian meringue instead of a French? Could the meringue be too stiff? Is the oven temperature too high at 180 Celsius? Are there any modern ingredients that I could add to improve the result? I'd really appreciate your advice. So, first of all, when we're talking about these macaron, whatever you want to call them, what we're referring to here, the La Durée style, is basically a sandwich style with either a ganache or a jelly filling in between two soft almond and egg white-based delicious things. They come in various colors, and they, like fried okra, are one of God's great creations. And I love them. So, okay, so here's the thing. I have a lot of things to say on this subject, right? But I will tell you that the first and foremost, I just walked up to one of our pastry chefs today and was like, all right, you know, this guy is having this problem. What do you think? Here's what Chef Jürgen, one of our lead pastry instructors, said. One, what kind of sugar are you using? If you're using a coarse sugar to make your meringue or to fold in with the sugar with the almonds, a finer grade of sugar. He also said that if your things are cracking and collapsing, perhaps you aren't deflating your egg whites enough before they go in. So there's too much air left in the mix, and it's puffing up too much and cracking and collapsing. I thought that was really interesting, because most of the time when you try to do a recipe with an egg white, you want to make sure not to deflate it. And he's saying, well, maybe you're not deflating it enough. I thought that was very interesting. The other thing is, I'm not sure, I didn't do the conversion from Celsius to Fahrenheit, but if your oven is too hot, it can puff up too fast and collapse. Also, remember, most recipes tell you to leave the door ajar when you're cooking these things, because I guess they want the steam to escape. So those are all things to look at. But in the course of researching your problem, I came across these things, which you may or may not find interesting. One is just a book that I think everyone should own, but nobody does. It's almost completely unavailable. It's called Perfect Bakery and Confectionery by the Richemont Craft School. And Nastasha's going to be gloating because I'm pumping a Swiss group, and she's like, she's Queen Switzerland. But this craft school in Switzerland puts out this series of books. But this one, Perfect Bakery Confectionery, is unavailable except through them. And it's like $99. It really makes me angry. And I can't find it on BookFind or anything, but it's one of the great pastry books, because what it does is it has pictures side by side of, hey, what happens when the flour is too fine, too coarse, just right, and it'll show you a picture of all the bakery stuff. So they have a 4-page section on macaroons, but they're unfortunately not the kind you're talking about. They're the old school Italian, denser, not sandwich based cookies. All right. Secondly, I will go through a a short history on the macaroon. So the macaroon, obviously, originally an Italian product, and apparently derived from the same word as a macaroni, because it's ground. It's basically any form of a kind of ground almond paste and sugar that is then has egg whites added to it, right? The French ones, you know, are beaten egg white, but they don't have to be beaten. They can just be mixed in for a denser macaroon. That was the original one taken to France with the Medici's when they went over, right? The coconut stuff is a later addition where almond was in whole or in part substituted with shredded coconut, and so that, you know, that's how the coconut macaroon. So most Americans, you ask them about a macaroon and they're thinking about a coconut product, but that was actually derived from the almond based one. Now the macaron that we're talking about, the sandwich, everyone credits this guy at La Durée in the early part of the 20th century with inventing it, right? And the guy's name, I forget what it is. I have it here. Pierre Desfontaines, right? It was the grandson of the original La Durée, right? They say he invented this idea of making a double-decker macaroon, putting ganache in the middle. And I don't think that's – I mean, that's what everyone says. That's what everyone on the internet says. But I was researching this, and I went to one of my other favorite pastry books, which you can actually get for free on the internets because it's old. It was written in 1904, and it's called Modern Baker, Confectioner, and Caterer, printed in 1907, rather, by John Kirkland. It's a four-volume set, and you can actually get them. It was published in England, and you can still get it cheap, and these are a fantastic set of books, state-of-the-art baking from 1907. And actually, I think they kept revising it up till 1930, and copies are still cheap. It's four volumes, and you can get each one for, like, you know, $13 if you're in England, but it shipped over here, it's like $20 because no one in the U.S. has them. It's an English-only thing, which is where I bought my copy. But I was researching macaroons then, and prior to when La Durée was supposed to have invented it, right, they had something where they would always sandwich the macaroons together to form a nice appearance. And that's why if you read recipes, and this is only for macaroon heads out there, they'll tell you to put it on parchment on and when you pull it off the baking sheet, to put some water between the parchment and the thing to make the macaroons come off easier. In fact, they were on wafer paper before and put on water, which would dissolve the wafer paper, and you could pull it off and the bottom would be tacky, and you could stick the two macaroons together to make a macaroon on macaroon sandwich. Now, one of the recommendations that this book makes that I think is very interesting is if you have problems sticking these two things together, right, then because maybe they're not wet enough or they're just not sticking, then you can take some apricot jelly, they recommend, and wipe it between, forming what up a standard La Durée style macaroon. So maybe this dude at La Durée humped up a bunch of macaroons one day and was like, these things aren't sticking together, and then put a ganache instead of a jelly in between them all and sold that as, like, you know, the cool thing, because they definitely popularized them. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Anyway, so those are my thoughts on macaroons, and you should definitely go out and look on the internet for Kirkland's Modern Baker and Confectionery, or buy a hard copy like I have. Has a really good section on molding and cornstarch, and has a lot of, I mean, even though it's very old, has a lot of if this goes wrong, do this, if that goes wrong, do this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Really great set of books. And they also have an interesting thing to say about macaroons. If you're making macaroons in the U.S., and old school, they're talking about old school Italian macaroons here, right? Is that they're very influenced by the amount of oil in the almond. So if you're making it from scratch with California almond, you're going to get a very different result from if you're making a macaroon with like a European or Marcone or something like that. It has very high fat content. So a lot of the California almonds we get have a lower fat content. And what they're saying is if your almonds don't flow well enough, if they're too pinched up, you're probably using an almond with not enough fat. And if they flow too freely, maybe you're using one with too much fat. They were talking about buying almond paste that were adulterated, either with non-fat products or with extra fat. But it's something that I never thought about. I thought it was very, very interesting. Anyway, so that's that for the macaroon. I love macaroons. Don't you love macaroons?
I would like one right now.
I would like one right now as well. Anyway, okay. So... Now on to the last question. I have to reach over and get the paper. We are a paper-based show today instead of an iPad-based show today, which is very interesting. Okay, Joe Blute, who is at Dallas. Where is he? Dallas College, right? I don't know the first page of it. Dallas.
Dallas.
Yes, okay. Dallas. Anyway, he writes in and says some very kind words about us. And he said he had a couple. couple of questions, right? So one, he's by the way thinking of building his own rotary evaporator, and he's a chemistry major at the University of Dallas. He's thinking about building his own rotary evaporator. So am I, Joe. But unfortunately, I haven't had the time to do it. Hopefully, sometime very soon, I will have the opportunity to do that. More on that in a couple minutes. But he also is looking for a budget centrifuge, and I think we posted on that a couple times, trying to find a budget centrifuge. Don't go too budget, right? Make sure that the centrifuge is safe. That's what I'm gonna say. But he has a question that I want to get to, and he says, "I really love the multifaceted aspect of the culinary arts that you get to deal with, and what you do is something I am interested in. The mixture of organic surfactant and kinetic chemistry is fascinating. How do you come to have such a great job, and what do you recommend I do to move towards such a position?" Okay, here's what I say. One. You know, food science is – we don't do food science, right? We use science to make food, which is kind of a fundamental difference. Like I can't do quantitative chemistry. I can't do anything like that. All the stuff we do, there's no real analytical work. It's all using principles and ideas with either standard kitchen cooking ware or things that we've repurposed as standard kitchen cooking ware. So when I'm using a centrifuge, I'm not using a centrifuge to do to analyze something. I'm using it to try and create a delicious product, right? When I use a rotary evaporator, I mean, although I am purifying and distilling, I'm not doing it for the same reasons that a chemist does. It's not part of an analytical study, right? Or even a production of like a drug or something like that. So what I do is very specialized, and we read a lot of science, and I love science, and I do, and you know, I love it. But what I'm actually doing day to day is cooking, and so what you have to do to kind of get to do the kind of stuff that I get to do is cook a lot, you know, and so. And not just with science and tech stuff, just do a lot of cooking. You need to have a lot of cooking under your belt. You need to love cooking. You need to love tasting. You need to taste everyone else's stuff. You need to be curious about all different ingredients and what they do and how they interact. You know, I think McGee said it best when he wrote a book called The Curious Cook, and that's the name of his second book, sadly out of print. Hopefully he brings it back into print. It's a very personal book, and it basically just shows that what you need to be McGee is to be like a real sweetheart and also smart, very smart, and also read a lot. But be very curious and be very observant about food. And that's, what you really need to do. The second part of it is you have to make friends in the food world. That's the sad truth. You know, you could sit around and be, know a lot and do a lot. And if you don't have friends, it's hard to network and get an actual job where someone will pay you. And so luckily nowadays, it's a lot easier with the internet to get to know people and to become more known in these kinds of subjects, because the subject matter, people, it's a very small group who, care about technology cooking, but it's, you can kind of get in touch with them more than you used to. But of course, the bar is higher than it was, let's say six years ago when I started, doing this, or 5 years ago when I started working at the French Culinary, there were fewer people who were known for doing it, and the bar to entry was lower. So anyway, that's what I recommend. Cook a lot, get to know some people in the food world, and eat a lot and cook a lot. That's basically the answer. And while we get to it, he says, "Thank you for putting your experimentation online. It's been a pleasure reading about them, and hopefully I can try some of them eventually. Again, thank you for the compliment." And I will say, we apologize yet again for the lack of posting we've had recently. We've been very busy, very, very, very busy, and working on some new ventures. So I am now officially March 1st going to basically be starting my own consulting company, which is why we haven't been posting so much. I'm still going to be the director of culinary technology at the French Culinary Institute. I'm still going to be teaching classes, and I'm still going to be maintaining cooking issues as the French Culinary Institute's cooking blog. And you'll be happy to note, people who bother me about not posting, that I will be contractually obliged to write one post a week, or at least four a month. It allows us to do some other fun stuff. Like, we can take on outside people if they want to work, do stuff for cooking issues. So if there's someone out there who is doesn't mind getting beaten down, because we'll beat you down, doesn't mind you know, who's a complete perfectionist when it comes to like thinking about things, right? Who you know what I mean, right, Nastasha? I mean, I'm a pain in the butt.
You are a pain in the butt.
Yeah, but you know, if you like the style, right, and if you think the way that we think, you know, then maybe, you know, if it doesn't bother you spending, you know, a zillion years worried about what's going on inside of a corn kernel during nixtamalization, well, you know, maybe, and you want to do this for little to no remuneration, maybe you too could work with Cooking Issues. And that's this week's Cooking Issues. We hope to hear from you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.